Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Jennifer Marohasi makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and Peter Ridd makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce our speakers briefly. On the occasion of the publication of the book Climate Change, The Facts 2017, both of our speakers have a contribution in that collected, that book of essays. So we'll lead off with Professor Peter Ridd, who's Professor of Physics at the James Cook University in Townsville. He's a published author of more than 100 papers and the book Physical Processes in Mango Swamps. His marine geophysics laboratory invented instruments for measuring sediment concentrations in the Great Barrier Reef. Jennifer Marohasi has a degree in science and a PhD from the University of Queensland. She's currently a senior fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs. She's based in Noosa and involved in forecasting and column writing and whatever. So we lead off with Professor Ridd. We go to Dr. Marohasi and then questions discussion. Many thanks.
All right, thanks very much. So I'm going to talk about the Great Barrier Reef and also mostly about the problems with quality assurance in science. We'll see how that goes. So you've heard about the Great Barrier Reef. It's on its last legs. All these things are killing the reef from sediments, nutrients, pesticides, dredging, coral calcification, stopped by acidification, global warming. At least three of those things, according to some scientists, have killed half the reef each. So, you know. And then there's another list on the right-hand side, which I don't have time to go into. So we've heard of coral mass coral death. Mainly by bleaching, but there's lots of other things that are supposedly killing the reef. And really, it's a story made in heaven for the media, because the thing about corals is it tends to die in a very spectacular way and then grow back very, very quietly while the media and the scientists aren't watching. Right, so the first thing is the bleaching, and we need a little marine biology lesson. A coral is a little animal about that size, and inside the polyp, there are these things called the zooxanthellae, and they're an algae, and they actually produce the energy from the sunlight for the coral. And this is a masterpiece of it ends up being a masterpiece of adaptation, this symbiotic relationship between the polyp and the algae. And it allows remarkable adaptability to temperature changes. So the thing about the coral, the bleaching, is that when the coral gets hot, and also when it gets cold, actually, but when it gets hot, it will sometimes eject the zooxanthellae and it turns white. But it's not a death sentence. In fact, you can actually look at it as more of a survival strategy. Most of the corals that actually bleach will recover. And in fact, the corals are not born with these zooxanthellae, these algae. They actually capture it from the surrounding water. And there's lots of different types of zooxanthellae that they can capture. So over the last 200 million years, in fact, what's ended up happening is the corals are playing this game of Russian roulette. They can take in a type of zooxanthellae that's just floating around in the water that I would call, say, a low-octane zooxanthellae, and this will give them a resistance to bleaching. So they can take the high temperature, but on the other hand, it means they'll grow slowly. So you can see there's a trade-off there. Or on the other hand, they can take a high-octane zooxanthellae. It'll make them grow really fast, but if there's a hot weather event, they may die. In some cases, a coral might bleach, throw out one particular type of zooxanthellae, but it can actually bring in a different type of zooxanthellae, which might make it more adaptable or more less susceptible to the high temperature event. So you can see there's this remarkable ability to adapt to temperature. We should also remember that it's these short-lived acropora, the staghorn and the plate-type coral, that are by far the most susceptible to bleaching. Now, the thing about these things is that they have a very short lifetime, maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years. If bleaching doesn't kill them, then a cyclone will kill them. Cyclones go across the reef very frequently, and you can regard these as the weeds of the reef. There is no point in these things growing slowly. Because they're going to get killed in 10 years' time anyway. So that's one of the reasons why they like to grow fast, but they're more susceptible to bleaching. On the other hand, these great big corals like these things, these can be hundreds of years old, and they're far less susceptible to bleaching. They're like the big forest trees. Okay, in fact, even if there was never any climate change, which obviously there is over hundreds of millions of years, corals must be very able to adapt to temperature changes, because a coral that, say, spawns where I'm from here in Townsville, the spawn may drift with the current and settle hundreds of kilometres away where the water is much hotter, or it may drift hundreds of kilometres away where it's colder. It might drift inshore where it's hotter, or it might go deeper where it's colder by 2 or 3 degrees, but certainly more than 1 degree, and much more than the temperature change that's happened over the last 100 years. So unlike a forest tree, which will drop the seed more or less in the same place as the offspring will be in the same place as the parent, in the case of corals, it's likely to be in a completely different temperature environment. And the other thing is, in fact, that corals are a tropical species. They like it hot. You have rubbish coral in Sydney compared with we have, because it's too cold. If you actually plot the coral growth rate versus the temperature, you actually get a nice, more or less linear relationship. The hotter it is, the faster corals grow. And in fact, more or less all the species of coral that live on the Great Barrier Reef also live around Thailand in Papua New Guinea, where it's 1 or 2 degrees hotter, and they grow faster there. But certainly, last year we had a nasty bleaching event that killed a lot of corals in the northern zone. But as I'm going to say, there's a lot of bad science around, in my view. And I believe that survey had major problems, the biggest one being that the survey only looked at corals that were 2 metres from the surface. Now, in fact, that's exactly where the hot water is. In a bleaching event where the water is very calm, no wind, the top 3 to 5 metres gets very hot, but the coral goes right down to 40 metres, and none of the deep coral was properly surveyed. So we actually don't really know how bad that bleaching event was. It certainly was a nasty one, there's no doubt about it, but you can't necessarily believe the numbers. And in fact, if you look over many years, so this is over the last 20 or 30 years, for the Northern Great Barrier Reef, and the numbers from about 1990 are certainly very reliable, you see that for the northern region, it went along at about 20%, and then it fell down, right? This is the nasty bleaching event which we had. The central region bounces around. These are large changes, you know, between 10 and 20%. So 100% or a 50% change in the coral cover over periods of 5 or 10 years. For the southern Great Barrier Reef, you see it come along this massive crash in 2010-11. Tropical cyclone Hamish wiped out enormous amounts of the reef. The amount of coral cover dropped to less than 50% of what it originally was, but over the last 5 years it's actually bounced back. So there's now 3 times more coral in the southern GBR than there was half a decade ago. Massive recovery there. For the Great Barrier Reef as a whole, bouncing around, hit a low point, it then bounced back quite nicely by 2015, came back down in 2016, and I'm expecting the 2017 will be a bit lower again too because of a cyclone and another bleaching event. But in 5 or 10 years' time, I think we can expect it to come back. So we should think of bleaching as a bit like a bushfire. It looks very nasty, but it recovers from that. And there's a lot of other questionable science on the Great Barrier Reef. Here's a little bit. This is the coral growth rate. Supposedly, it collapsed in about 1990. We reanalyzed this data, and in fact, there was no collapse. There were 2 major mistakes with the science behind that supposed collapse. Another group, actually using different measurements, reckoned that between 1940 and the present, there's been an 11% increase in the coral growth rates on 99% of the area of the Great Barrier Reef. But there's been a 5% decrease in an area which is only 1% of the reef. But instead of saying this is obviously a good news event, no, they don't see it's a good news event. They say our new findings nevertheless continue to raise concern, properly reflecting the effects of CO2-driven climate change. So a remarkable conclusion from the result that there's more coral now than there was, or higher growth rates. You've probably heard of the problem of all the sediment from agriculture. We've done a huge number of measurements on that. And there's actually about 100 times more sediment that is resuspended completely naturally and always has been than actually comes out of these rivers. So in my view, sediment is also not a problem. There's some interesting pictures. These have gotten me into trouble over the years. So we've got a reef in 1883 and supposedly the same reef today showing absolutely no coral. I sent my guys down there, and in fact you see that there's excellent coral in that particular location. So pictures maybe don't lie, but sometimes maybe they do. Right, so what do scientists want to do to save the reef? Well, they want to close down the coal industry, they do want to take sugarcane land out of production, they want to reduce the fertiliser rates, they want to stop clearing rangeland regrowth, and all the bad publicity is massively affecting the tourist industry. Well, if you take all those industries away from North Queensland, we actually don't have a great deal left. So, what are the quality assurance mechanisms that we are using to make sure that this science is right? Well, it boils down to a thing called peer review, which you may think sounds all very impressive, that you know maybe a dozen scientists consider this work for a month or so. Well, it's nothing like that. Peer review is usually a review by two people, and that may only last a couple of hours each, and that's it. So this guy Horton once said that peer review, we know the system of peer review is biased, unjust, unaccountable, incomplete, easily fixed, often insulting, usually ignorant, occasionally foolish, and frequently wrong. This guy's got a good turn of phrase, right? And, you know, peer review never involves going back and trying to replicate and do a proper survey of the work. Almost never. So how much of the work is likely to be wrong? Well, there's a thing called the replication crisis. And when you go home, you must Google the words replication crisis because it's a big deal now in the whole science literature. The same guy, this Lancet guy, said, "The case against science is straightforward. Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue. Afflicted by studies with small sample size, tiny effects, blah-bitty-blah-bitty-blah, science has taken a turn towards darkness." And I really think he's right on this. This guy's my hero, John Ioannidis. He is a mathematician working in the biomedical field. So this problem with science is right through. It's not just the environmental science, but the biomedical people know they have a problem. This guy has been at the forefront. He reckons that 85% of science resources are wasted because we're chasing false and exaggerated findings in the literature. And when the series of replication studies have been done over a wide range of fields, biomedical, education, psychology, criminology, we're finding about 50% of the published literature is wrong. When drug companies do replications of university work, this is a very interesting survey, came out in The Economist paper in Nature originally. They checked 60 or 70 original findings, and they found that 20% of the time the original work was right. Okay, so 80% of these major findings they found to be wrong. And the proverbial hit the fan after that, which was a good thing. So you've got to ask the question, is it reasonable to question the trustworthiness of science and scientific organisation if peer review is the primary form of QA/QC? And should it even be a controversial question to make these do these questions, given the replication crisis which is sweeping through the rest of science? I work a lot with engineers, and I used to take the proverbial out of those guys, but I actually now know that they are much more wise than scientists because they know about quality assurance. So on this slide here, I've got engineering quality assurance. It's called ISO 9000, right? When an engineer makes a mistake, the aeroplane crashes and there are mangled bodies in the wreckage. And that really plays on their minds. When a scientist makes a mistake on the Great Barrier Reef, and they've been saying the reef has been dying for about 50 years now, well, we actually don't even know for another 30 years whether they're right or wrong. We certainly don't check the work. So I do the analogy. This is an aeroplane that's made by an engineer, and this is an aeroplane that's made by a scientist. And, you know, We're told that we should respect scientists and science, right? And we should, because, you know, they get it right half the time. That plane will only crash half the time. Because that's what the replication crisis is telling us, right? That half the science is probably wrong. And it's not just the GBR stuff. That's how I got into it. And then I realised when I went into the literature, actually it's much worse, it's much broader. So what I'm on about at the moment is trying to introduce methods by which we can actually bring the trust back into science, because there should be no trust at the moment, in fact. And in fact, some of you guys might not believe in the global warming thing. It doesn't actually matter. What we should actually be looking at now is introducing systems where, for what I'm calling policy science, that's the science for which governments base big public policy decisions, we can no longer rely, or we should never rely on peer review. We should take that science and subject it to a far more rigorous testing, checking and replication process. So Scott Pruitt, the new US EPA chairman, is talking about these red teams and blue teams. So you actually have a fight. You know, the red team reckons the reef is dying. Fine. Well, let's now have a blue team to test those things, and obviously on all other sorts of policy. I think we need a thing called an Institute for Policy Science Quality Assurance that would do this, not just on environmental work, but actually on a whole lot of other science upon which governments use science. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Ridd. Dr. Mara Hersey.
Yeah. Good evening. It's wonderful to be at the Sydney Institute. Thank you so much, Anne and Jared, for the invitation. Sydney is known for its opera house, built on a platform jutting into the harbour, with vertical concrete walls extending down into the water. I've looked across at the Opera House and the concrete walls from so many different vantage points over the years, especially on New Year's Eve when it's all lit up with fireworks. It should be easy to observe the sea level rise up those walls over the years. Assuming we have catastrophic human-caused climate change. As I speak tonight, not far from the Opera House, sea levels are in fact falling. That's correct, falling. The tide is falling from a high of 1.46 metres at 5:25 p.m., just almost an hour ago, to a low of 0.42 metres forecast for midnight. I know this from the Tide Times as published by the Bureau of Meteorology. So in the next few hours, sea levels in Sydney Harbour will fall over 1 metre, okay? But of course, it's the longer term trend, not the daily rise and fall of more than 1 metre, that the political class tell us we should be so concerned about. So what does the longer term record indicate for Sydney Harbour? A rise of 0.65 millimetres per year between 1885 and 2010. That's the official rate of sea level rise at Fort Denison, which of course is just across from the Opera House. And that's the rate as reported by the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, known more generally as NOAA. You heard me correctly if you heard 0.65 millimetres per year as the rate of sea level rise, considering the period since 1885. That's less than 1 millimetre per year. Of course, compounded, this could add up. It could add up to 6.5 centimetres after 100 years. But of course, neither sea level nor temperature rise in a monotonic way. What I mean is they don't just keep going up. Rather, they cycle. There's the daily cycle, the monthly cycle, the cycle associated with El Niño and El Niño events. And then there are the longer cycles, including the cycles associated with ice ages and interglacial warm periods. For example, at the end of the last proper ice age, which was about 16,000 years ago, sea levels rose vertically about 100 metres. That's correct, over 100 metres. Before then, it was possible to walk across to Tasmania. We are now about 10,000 years into this relatively warm period known as the Holocene. And during a period known as the Mid-Holocene High Stand, which was about 6,000 years ago, sea levels were about 2 metres higher than they are now, right along the east coast of Australia. 2 metres higher than they are now. And they didn't actually start to fall quite dramatically until about 2,000 years ago. Now, none of what I've just told you about sea level change along the east coast of Australia, including Sydney Harbour, is in any way controversial. The Bureau's tide times forecast a fall of over 1 metre by midnight tonight. NOAA indicate there's been a rise over the last 100 years of just 0.065 metres per year. And the scientific literature indicates sea levels have fallen about 2 metres over the last 2,000 years. In summary, those with some numerical literacy might conclude the more significant long-term trend is one of falling. But this, of course, is denied by the political class who rule over us, particularly facilitated by the bias and agenda at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I've never once heard Tony Jones mention sea levels falling. Furthermore, if you were, for example, just to blurt out, sea levels are falling, you would likely be labelled a deplorable, meaning you are bad, wretched, and a subject for censure or reproach. As I wrote in the introduction to this book, Climate Change, the Facts, 2017, this book that we're celebrating tonight, that's on sale this evening, that I edited, the introduction begins, "There are certain things best not discussed with neighbours over the fence, at barbecues and at gatherings of the extended family." These topics used to include sex and politics, but more recently, climate change has become a sensitive issue. So rather than discuss the issue of climate change with your neighbour, why not just get a few copies of this book and simply hand them over the fence. Each of the chapters in the book has been written by a skeptic, someone who dares to doubt. To be clear, none of the authors of any of the 22 chapters denies that climate change is real. But instead we point out how extremely complex the topic of Earth's climate is. And indeed, this is not a book with just one message, except perhaps that there is a need for more scrutiny of the data and of your neighbours' prejudices. Fundamental to the sceptic's perspective on climate change is the fact that there are natural climate cycles, including cycles relating to sea level rise and fall. And that even the most extreme portrayal of late 20th century warming is within what we might expect from a natural cycle at the end of the Holocene, the period we're currently in. For example, in Chapter 3, Nicholas Scafetta from the Meteorological Observatory at the University of Naples, so writing in Chapter 3 of this book, discusses these natural cycles and explains how variations in solar luminosity caused by the gravitational electromagnetic oscillations of the heliosphere due to the revolution of the planets around the sun can drive cycles, can drive oscillations in climate. But then there are those from geography departments at other universities who will argue it is the impact of changes in the composition of the Earth's atmosphere that are having much more impact on sea level and temperature and the Great Barrier Reef, and so the list goes on. It was actually back in 1896, that Svante Arrhenius, a chemist, theorised that a doubling of atmospheric carbon dioxide could lead to a 5 to 6 degree increase in global temperatures. His calculations were purely speculative and undertaken before modern high-resolution spectroscopy, which has actually enabled the measurement of the absorption and emission of infrared radiation by carbon dioxide. And this is all explained in Chapter 19 by chemist John Abbott and physicist John Nicol. And they explain how the actual measurements from spectroscopy, measurements conveniently ignored by the IPCC and so many geographers and meteorologists, they ignore the last 30 years of spectroscopy as published in the scientific literature, and how we get sensitivities in these IPCC climate models that grossly overestimate the actual situation, how these overestimations persist in the computer simulation models. There is a lot of controversy. In fact, the science is hardly settled when you get into the so many diverse issues that really should be discussed if we care about understanding climate science. And there's a lot in this book about science, from physics to cycles to the Great Barrier Reef. Peter Ridd wrote Chapter 1 about the Great Barrier Reef, and Chapter 2 is about ocean acidification. We do also have some chapters on the economics, because the science, the economics, far-reaching implications affecting the economy in Australia and around the world today. Matt Ridley, for example, begins Chapter 14 in this book with the claim that global warming is actually doing more economic good than harm, particularly through greening the planet. In Chapter 15, Bjorn Lomborg explains the economics of the Paris Accord. He explains that adhering to the Paris Accord is going to be very expensive, while actually hardly affecting the global climate at all, which is perhaps why so many are increasingly investing so much in attempting to close down open and honest discussion on these topics. My colleague at the IPA, Simon Brini, explains in Chapter 17 that some in academia are leading the charge for extending the criminal law to the punishment of climate heresy on the basis it is moral negligence and ought to be extended to all activities that seek to undermine the public's understanding of the scientific consensus. Of course, the notion of a consensus is fundamental to modern politics, but is generally alien to traditional science, at least Enlightenment science, as practiced by true sceptics. In reality, and to paraphrase Willie Soon from Harvard University, who wrote Chapter 11 in this book with Sally Ballyunas, there is as yet no coherent theory of climate. Rather, as Pat Michaels, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, explains in Chapter 18, the mainstream climate science community is wasting so much time cherry-picking data from weather balloons and satellites, all in an attempt to make the temperature data consistent with a particular and somewhat broken paradigm that places too much emphasis on carbon dioxide. There are many chapters in this book about homogenisation of the surface temperature record. Chapters 5, 6, 7, 8 and 9 by Anthony Watts, Tony Heller, Tom Quirk, Joe Nova and myself respectively. Homogenisation in essence involves the remodelling of data and is now a technique integral to the development of key official national and international data sets. And the data sets used by the IPCC underpinning the Paris Accord. To explain homogenization, I'd have to show you some beautiful charts. There's actually more than 80 colored charts in this book, and I'd require an amount of time to do that. I'm going to put more in my speech notes, which Anne will publish. But in the meantime, I suggest that you buy the book and read the chapters 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, perhaps beginning with chapter 9, which is about the homogenization of Rutherglen, chapter 9. The satellite data is also a very valuable resource for understanding global and regional temperature change and is the subject of chapter 12 in our book, which is written by Roy Spencer. Roy Spencer is the science team leader for the Advanced Microwave Scanning Radiometer on the NASA Aquasatellite. And he's been doing this work for 30 years now. In the final chapter, my favourite poet, Clive James, effectively places the current obsession with catastrophic climate change, imminent sea level rise, the demise of the Great Barrier Reef, in a broader cultural context. He writes, and I quote, that the current obsession will die hard, but there is no need to entertain visions of a vast, old-style army of disoccupied experts retreating through the snow, eating first their horses and finally each other. But there could be quite a lot of previously well-subsidized people left standing around while they wonder why nobody is listening to them anymore. I don't listen to the ABC anymore. And I recommend that over Christmas you turn it off and start reading some good books, including this one. In chapter 4, you can even read about the moon. The moon, of course, has a dominant influence on the sea tides that affect sea level. And they are often highest, this is sea level, the tides, in Sydney Harbour, on a full moon in early January. And tonight, if you go to bed before midnight, you can do so in the knowledge that sea levels are falling in Sydney Harbour and have been for about 2,000 years, considering the longer term trend. Thank you very much.
You come over here. That way, yeah. So now we come to our questions and discussion. As I said, we've got some copies of Climate Change: The Facts, 2007. Peter, just stay here. Oh, I see. 2017 for sale up there. It's for sale for $35, and I'm sure that the editor and one of the contributors will be happy to sign that tonight. And so we come to questions discussion. There are a lot of people here, so keep your comments or questions brief. Let's start off, if I start off with Peter. My brush with fame in life really is that I once worked for the former Queensland Premier's Campbell Newman's father. And 40 years ago, he was the Minister for the Environment in the Fraser government, and I was on his staff. And I remember then, and you made the point towards the end of your speech, we were told then, that's nearly half a century ago, that the Great Barrier Reef was ruined, finished, and all sorts of things had to be done and all sorts of money had to be found to fund it. Now, you've mentioned that briefly, but among the colleagues that you deal with, and why do you think that these kind of messages come out? I mean, is this just the human condition repeating itself? Or is there something else to it? I mean, because the facts don't seem to, as you mentioned, the facts don't seem to support the theory, but the theory keeps being repeated.
That's a very good question. I think part of it is that... No, there's something I'd like to say, but I can't say it. Okay? No, I can't say it. There's something that I'd really like to say, but I can't say.
Whisper it.
And if you ask me that question when the camera's not rolling, I will give you the answer to that question. I'm sorry, Pat. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, folks, stay around after question time. Now, here we go. I can't find my microphone at the moment. Peter, just come up. Richard, over there.
I was lucky enough to attend the launch of the book, and one thing that struck me since, and particularly as you said, Peter, what about the challenges that have been made by those who believe in climate change to the publication? Because it seemed to me that what you were talking about earlier, about the lack of replication, well, here was a great chance. You put it all easily readable on paper.
Yes.
Who's come to say you're wrong, and had the proof?
So just before you answer, what's been, for those who didn't pick it up, what's been the response to the factual contributions in your book? Has it been refuted?
No, they never argue with me, right? This is the thing that always happens. It was the same with Bob Carter. Nobody would argue, right? So I've been basically saying for the last 10, 15 years that a lot of the science supposedly showing damage to the Great Barrier Reef is exaggerated, but they never argue with that. They do other things, and that's why I'm not able to answer that previous question.
Okay, so there's a question here.
Thank you. To what extent do you think that scientists, also in raw fields, particularly maybe in the environmental field, their work and their pronouncements are being affected by the Australian national media?
Essentially, don't blame the media. Blame the scientists, all right? It's the scientists. You know, every university will have half a dozen media people pumping stuff in. Every big government-run institution will have a similar sort of thing. So they're feeding the science. If the science is wrong and it's saying that the reef is very badly damaged, then the media will just report that. So the fundamental problem is not the media exaggerating it. You can't exaggerate a statement like half the Great Barrier Reef is dead, all right? They're just repeating what the scientists are saying. The thing is, the original bit of science actually is not properly tested, checked and replicated. That's the fundamental problem. So you must always go back to the problems that we've got in science. Unless we fix science, then we will never fix these other problems.
I'm not going to disagree with respect to the Great Barrier Reef, but I do think in other areas there is a responsibility for the media to actually seek out, for example, to not just assume that the IPCC's pronouncements are correct. And, for example, they could grab our book, Climate Change, the Facts 2017, they could read it and they say, well, we've actually got some experts in spectroscopy like John Nicol. Who's currently retired, living in Brisbane, spent a fair bit of time at the Clarendon Laboratory in Oxford, probably knows a thing or two about this, can tell us a little bit about climate sensitivity. It may require a bit of a longer, you know, story. It may be quite controversial, and maybe the IPCC people will embargo stories from that journalist that reported that story in the first instance. But if the journalists across Australia rose up and started reporting some of the misinformation that the Bureau of Meteorology put out, then we would actually have a situation where the general public got closer to the truth, because at the moment they don't get anywhere near the truth when it comes to so many issues, from the Great Barrier Reef to climate sensitivities to historical temperature reconstructions. There's just one story that's being repeated and repeated, and there is no opportunity for dissent apart from a few places like the Sydney Institute. Thank you so much, Anne and Jared.
Just before we go to a question, to be fair, following up Peter's point, I think you mentioned Tony Jones, but many of the journalists don't have degrees in science or engineering. So how are they to know? I mean, if they're not qualified to read the literature.
There are scientists who may have In the last 10 years, a lot of scientists who have spoken out have lost their jobs. But those scientists are still there within the community. And some of them have fantastic qualifications. They have publications in the relevant areas, but they aren't being sought out because journalists who report them are often often made fun of by other journalists, particularly by our ABC. It actually goes after politicians and scientists and journalists who report an alternative perspective. And this is Australia in 2017. It's not Russia in 1917. It's extraordinary the extent to which there is no tolerance of alternative perspectives in the scientific area at this point in our history.
I'd like to add to that. You're right. There's no tolerance. There's also no tolerance in universities of those sorts of things, right? But going back to the other point that Jen made was that most of the journalists just can't accept the horrible reality that our scientific system is broken. They just can't accept the possibility that the CSIRO and other organisations are using a system of QA which essentially makes those results, and this is where I come to the same problem that I had before, right? Because I can't say now what I need to be able to say. And I work at a university, and I can't say what I want to be able to say. And that's a really bad place that we've got into with our university system.
There's a question here.
Jennifer, going on from that, your big case this year has been the way in which temperature is measured. There's a whole mechanical explanation for this, and you've said we've changed our measurements. Could you give us some simple explanation to ordinary lay people? I understand it vaguely, how we've gone from one kind of measurement to another, which has now made apples and eggs comparisons, and you challenge the whole idea that we have lived through the hottest year, etc.
So in 1996, the Australian Bureau of Meteorology moved from using, for example, mercury thermometers as the core instrument for measuring maximum temperatures across Australia to using electronic probes. And that happened more than two decades ago now, and yet there's been no actual assessment of whether the measurements from the electronic probes are equivalent to the measurements from the mercury thermometers. And the parallel data that has been collected, and a whistleblower has told me that there's 37 places where we there's hundreds of weather stations across Australia, but there's 37 where we have parallel measurements, and I'm asking for the data from the electronic probes and the mercury thermometers so that we can just compare the measurements, and that data is not being made available. Extraordinary that data, one, it shouldn't be for me to ask for the data. The measurements and this work should have been done and published by the Bureau of Meteorology, at least in the peer-reviewed literature. There are faults with peer review, but at least there's the potential for getting information out there. When it comes to something as basic as the historical temperature record over the last 30 to 60 years, it really is questionable because we've had a whole change in equipment and no honest, objective assessment of that impact on maximum and minimums, which is likely to have been significant.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a question there.
Yeah, thanks for that. I think also with the difference in temperature measurement mechanisms, the electronic probes respond faster and therefore are likely to show quick bursts of high temperature, which then become the maximum, which the mercury thermometers wouldn't do. I was in Melbourne yesterday.
It'll be brief.
And the Weather Bureau said we have a historic temperature, high temperatures, 150 years records are broken. So what they're really saying, that 150 years ago it was as hot as it is now.
They weren't measuring temperatures in Melbourne the same way that they're measuring now. So not only do we have the growth in the city of Melbourne, but we actually also have very significantly equipment changes. But if I can also mention that everywhere else around the world, because a lot of places around the world have moved to electronic probes, and for example, in the UK, in India, in Kuwait, in Switzerland, in Germany, they don't take 1 second readings from the electronic probes. In those countries, they average the readings over, they take 1 second readings and then they average over a minute, and then they call that the maximum if it's the highest for the day. In the US, they average over 5 minutes. In Australia, the Bureau of Meteorology is taking 1 second spot readings and reporting them as daily maximum. Now, that's not controversial. It is something that I have been bringing to people's attention. It's not denied by the Bureau, but it's not generally understood. So we have a system of measurement that is actually not even consistent with calibration in terms of World Meteorological Organization recommendations for measurements from electronic probes.
There's a question up there, sir.
Jeff Cox. Whoops. Jeff Cox, North Queensland, Cane Farm. Perhaps I can help you with some of the explanation of why Peter Ridd's science isn't challenged. The science might not be in, but the politics are. It is so convenient to use this as a very convenient political tool to impress people in southern electorates. Every time a southern politician wants to score points and display their humanity and social conscience, they rip up and save the Great Barrier Reef at no cost to their own electorate. Now, how good is that? So, as a cane farmer, I'm just making a statement here.
But okay. If you like your question. We've got to be brief. Okay, let's stop at the area. Jennifer, do you want to respond to that?
Certainly, you said the politics is in. We have so much science which is policy-based rather than evidence-based, and we really need to get back to science that's evidence-based rather than policy-based. And that really requires all of us to care about the truth and to care about the science and to recognise that great civilizations move forward on the basis of evidence, on the basis of fact, on the basis of reality, rather than on the basis of belief systems.
I just should make a point here. I'm making it off the top of my head, but I think it's true to say that Professor Ridd has had certain potential actions taken against him or moves against him in his academic position, which makes it difficult for him to talk on these matters. At the Sydney Institute, on the other hand, we've heard all these views and all this debate, all different kind of views, and we're always happy to hear different kind of views, and so on we go. There's a question. We've got to keep the comments brief, okay?
If I can just make a comment. Peter very graciously contributed a chapter to Climate Change, the Facts, chapter one, and was in Sydney for the launch of the book and spoke on Sky Television about the problems of peer review and quality of assurance. And since then, there have been moves to have him dismissed, removed from the university. There has been significant support, including funding from the Institute of Public Affairs, for his legal defence. And those papers were filed in the federal court last Monday, and I think we will all learn more about this. Maybe you can invite him back in a couple of years to talk about this. But at this point in time, we are fighting to keep Peter at James Cook University, because we must keep Peter at James Cook University.
Okay, we're going back. Brief.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. My question is, you were talking about the very, very slow sea level rises. Has it ever been consistent that there may be isostatic readjustment going on, and would geodetic surveys tell us anything, because we do know that this isostatic adjustment is going on in different parts of the world.
Absolutely, and the east coast of Australia, there's some areas that are moving up and down. I know South Australia, I've done a lot of work on the Murray, at the end of the Murray River, it's and Adelaide, for example, is sinking, so that affects sea level. We've got the Northern Hemisphere, and Peter may be able to...
Can talk about the reef.
Peter can talk about the reef and this issue.
The reef is very interesting because of isostatic rebound amongst other things. Because the sea level was about 1 metre higher on the Great Barrier Reef, say about 5,000 years ago, when it fell, it actually killed the top of the reef. So large amounts of the reef are now dead with no coral on at all. Ironically, if the sea level does rise by a metre, as the IPCC says, there'll actually be an explosion of coral on these presently dead areas, which might be 30% increase in coral areas where the coral can actually grow. So sure, it would be pretty bad for Bangladesh or a low-lying Pacific island, but actually for the reef it would be a good thing, even though a lot of the scientists say that even sea level rise is somehow damaging for the corals. I can never understand how they work that one out.
So it'd be good for Queensland tourism, in other words. There's a question I can't... I wanted to go up there, Anne, if you can take them up. Got to be brief, okay?
Yeah, thank you very much. Accepting all you say, is there not some damage caused by pollution from hydrochloric gases, and also from diesel fumes and vehicle fumes and things?
You mean on the
atmosphere? Does that do some harm to the atmosphere and to the world or not?
Well, diesel fumes will have some effect on the, in cities, but not on a large scale. In terms of CFCs, in my view, that's another one of these big science stories which has never really been properly checked. People are going to town on the, people like Jen and lots of other people are looking at the global warming thing. But in fact, the CFC scare and the ozone hole came before that. And we introduced all sorts of legislation, and I don't know, but I just wonder about that, because it falls into the category of unchecked science, and you've just got to assume that half of it was wrong. So there's a 50-50 chance whether that's right or wrong.
There's a question.
Thank you very much for great presentations. My question relates to the Great Barrier Reef in comparison to reefs elsewhere. How does the behaviour of the Great Barrier Reef differ from those others in terms of the detrimental or significant up-surging effects?
Well, the Great Barrier Reef is easily the best reef anywhere, apart from maybe some reef out in the middle of the Pacific, essentially because there's no people pressure. You've got this enormous reef, it's 2,000 kilometres long, it's got 500,000 people, and most of them never visit it. If you compare that with the reefs of the Caribbean, which is a similar size, you might have 50 million people, and they're eating every single little bit of protein that's floating around in the water. So the reef is in a wonderful condition compared with any of the other reefs, and it's really based on the fact that the population is small.
There is a saying that he who pays a piper calls the tune, and the problem with this scientific ethics is the fact that scientists mostly scramble after grants. Do you think that the election of Donald Trump in the U.S. will enable grants to go to the other side for a change? Do you have any evidence of that?
I hope that will happen, because that's what Scott Pruitt wants. But I've got to say that with the reef, most of the scientists are not just chasing grants, okay? They really believe that the reef is damaged, and I've got some reasons for why. I have some reasons why I think they think that, but that's one of those questions which I'm not allowed to answer.
Okay, so there's a question up there. Yeah,
I can't. I just had to ask, to what extent is government funding an issue in terms of eroding the reliability of science?
The question is, to what extent is government funding eroding the quality of science?
Well, if Peter talked this evening about blue teams and red teams, and there's no reason why government can't actually fund alternate perspectives. There's no reason why, for example, I mean, in the law, in criminal situations, governments don't let people just be convicted because somebody, a journalist claimed or a scientist claimed that they killed somebody. They actually have to present the evidence, and there's an opportunity for somebody to present alternative evidence. I don't think it would be that difficult for government to fund people to present alternate perspectives, and for there to be auditing of science where the scientists are asking for very large expensive public policy decisions to be made. But it seems that we've lost that desire for debate and discussion and to have to think and question within our culture. I'm not sure how that happened, when that happened, but it would require people to actually be interested in the alternate perspective, which I think is what we need to get back to. Why aren't people keen to hear from dissidents and sceptics, particularly on these issues?
Jen's absolutely right, especially on that last point. Why has this happened that we don't seem to now be interested in opposing views? And I think the reason must be sheeted home to the universities, all universities. Debate is now not necessarily a welcome thing in a university, and it's a very, very sad situation that we've got to.
But that's simply not just in science.
No.
It's
no.
in the social sciences.
Yeah, right across things, yeah.
There's a question. Go on.
We accept that climate change is real, as you suggested. To what extent would you say, in your view, that it's manifested itself over the longer term and short term? Where do you think that is the case, and how has it manifested itself colder and hotter over the medium term and the short term?
So, I actually have just had a paper published with John Abbott in GeoRes J, volume 14, and we actually looked, we decomposed natural cycles going back 2,000 years, and then looked at what would the temperature profile look like for various regions around the world post 1830, had there not been industrialization, had there not been a rise in atmospheric carbon dioxide. And what we found, and it's all documented in this published paper that has been somewhat controversial, our conclusions, which are that you would have nevertheless had warming, significant warming in the absence of an industrial revolution, and that at the most the difference is about 0.2 degrees.
Now we're just coming to the end, so I'd just ask a final question involving both of you. I mean, you're both scientists, you've both been very controversial, you've copped a lot of criticism. On the other hand, you're sort of a bit famous. I mean, I see you on the telly, you know, so you're pretty famous. So how do you bear up with all this? I mean, and what do you plan to do in the future? Are you going to antagonise the Bureau of Meteorology anymore, or what are you planning to do? And are you okay?
I love puzzle solving. I want to keep working in science. I keep on saying that I'm going to give it away. And but in the end, I'm fascinated by natural history, and I hear people on television make these claims, and I go and check, and I go, well, actually, it's not exactly like that. And then I think, well, I might write something about it. And and so there's, I guess, that part of my work that that in fact is why the IPA took me back 2 years ago when I was tossed out of Central Queensland University. However, I do like to continue with my hardcore research, and I would love to go back to a university if there's anyone out there which would have me.
Peter, what are you up to?
Well, I'm okay, all right? I'm okay. And what I'm going to be doing in the next few years is I'm working on this science quality assurance thing, because I'm telling you, it's going to happen. It's happening in lots of other parts of science where they realise they've got a problem, but there's a lot of other parts of science which are more political and they are in denial. But it won't be for long. 5 years, 10 years, I will win this one.
Very good. I know we had many other questions and comments, but it's right on the hour and we always finish on time. Just to remind you, there are copies of the book Climate Change, which is edited by Jennifer with a contribution by Peter. I think you've done five chapters in it. So, and I'm sure our speakers would be happy to sign that. Look, at the Institute, we have a policy. We're not like a university. We hear all kind of views. And many people come along here who disagree with Anne and myself, and they get heard, and we value that. And I'm sad that this is not happening these days in universities. But we'll hear many more opinions on the general issue of climate change at the Institute. Over the years, we've done that. Going back, I noticed we had a first discussion on it with someone from the CSIRO back in 1990, I noticed the other day. So Jennifer and Peter have continued this discussion today. Courageous people. It's not easy
you have
to be
been
against
listening
the fashions
to the Sydney Institute
and they've
podcast.
Both done extremely well.
This
and
podcast
also
is proudly brought to you through the support
of
Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening
so well done, Jennifer,
and can join
and good
us
luck
again
with the
soon.
Book.